7654321.
Hello, fight fans. Welcome back. This is another week of the MMA Cutmen. I'm your host, Kevin Mendelson. Across from me, as always, my co-host, Marcus Schmidley from MMAinterviews.tv. Marcus, a beautiful day here in Seattle. Sunshine and birds chirping. Perfect day to get up at 9 in the morning and watch some fighting.
Yeah, it was a nice change of pace being able to get up, as you mentioned it, 9 in the morning for some Facebook prelims of UFC action in Sweden. That card turning out to have a lot of violence to it. Main card action was sensational, and a lot of good topics to get to on today's show.
We've got the UFC on Fuel recap. We have a Bellator 65 recap. We're going to preview next weekend's big fight weekend with Bellator and the UFC going again. It's a good three-week stretch for these guys going all, with some really good cards coming at you. We'll also have some headlines, what you may have missed in the week in MMA coming up. As always, first things first, this morning, 9:30 a.m., start time for the prelims of the UFC on Fuel card. They were on Facebook, some great fights, as Marcus mentioned. With the main card, that's where you really got into the good stuff. Brad Pickett started the night off with Damasio Page, and that's a heck of a fight on paper between those two guys.
Yeah, it was. It eventually ended up being fight of the night, so Brad Pickett and Damasio Page are going to get $50,000 bonuses. Interesting fight. I thought Brad Pickett looked like he was the better fighter for the majority of the contest, but Damasio Page is not the kind of guy to go quietly into the night. He stands there and trades with anybody. He's been on the bad side of some losses in his UFC and WEC career, but he was game today against Brad Pickett. I thought Brad Pickett looked sensational. Some of the best boxing in the UFC, and he just doesn't get noticed because he's not a bigger guy. I think if he was a middleweight or a light heavyweight, people would really be slurping his boxing skills. Tiny guys don't get all the love all the time. Brad Pickett, though, victorious with the rear naked choke, 4 minutes and 5 seconds into round number two.
Brad Pickett has to be careful to not have his head too far forward. He has to stay with his hips lined up on Damasio Page's hips. And here he's trying to get the rear naked choke.
Pickett looking to lock it in.
He's got it.
Can I make an aside real quick before we go into the rest of the card? Isn't it nice to have Mike Goldberg back?
I enjoy Mike Goldberg. I thought it was a unique pairing with Kenny Florian today. I wasn't really expecting that. I was expecting either Joe Rogan to pop up somewhere or John Anik to sprout out of Mike Goldberg's head, but neither one of those situations happened. And I was actually very very excited for Kenny Florian's knowledge and his wisdom and his fight acumen. You know, paired with Mike Goldberg's Goldbergisms and all the stuff that we get with that. I thought it was a very nice pairing.
At some point, Florian actually called him Goldie, and the entire show was made for me. I was so happy about that. Up next, after Brad Pickett beat Damasio Page, John McGuire and Demarcus Johnson, second round submission. This seemed to be the theme as we were going into the early parts of the show.
Trying to get the leverage from half guard. He lost it, though. And now McGuire steps over.
And that's the
and he just absolutely took his arm and made it his.
It was one of the best transitions I've seen lately in mixed martial arts. Demarcus Johnson is a guy who has very good submission skills. He was a finalist on The Ultimate Fighter Season 9. A guy that I think it's interesting if you look at USC.com, they had Demarcus Johnson listed at 18-9. If you look online, he's listed at 15-10. A little bit of discrepancy between those two records. And I don't really know which one is which, but nevertheless, it was a transition that was interesting because Johnson was looking to lock up a Kimura. It looked like he had it. John McGuire just transitions beautifully into an armbar, and Demarcus Johnson, you know, coming towards the end of his UFC fight career, if he can't put away guys like John McGuire. John McGuire, though, 18-3 in his mixed martial arts career, advances to 2-0 in the UFC, so bigger things to come on the horizon for him.
After that, we had Dennis Siver and Diego Nunes. Dennis Siver, the spinning back kick master. Why can nobody, as you mentioned it earlier, nobody can really seem to get a good fight out of Diego Nunes? Why is that?
Well, I don't know. I mean, he's a very technical fighter. He's got range to him. He knows how to use his kicks well. He throws crisp technical strikes. I mentioned on Facebook earlier today as the fights were going down, it's just impossible to look like a world-class fighter against him. He doesn't win a lot of these fights that he's been in recently. He dropped a fight to Kenny Florian, earlier in the year, maybe in 2011. You know, Dennis Seaver's another lightweight convert to featherweight, just like Kenny Florian. And this is the second fight in a row that Diego Nunes drops to a guy that's probably naturally bigger than him. But Dennis Seaver didn't really look like he had a huge advantage at any point in the fight. I mean, he does take a 29-28 decision. Very interesting fight. It's hard to look good when you're fighting Diego Nunes, but nevertheless, Dennis Seaver's, you know, quality kickboxer, Russian-born German. I think a lot of fight fans in Sweden got their money's worth.
And after that, we saw Ciara
Bahadurzada.
Thank you. I practiced this before the show. I had it right. And in the time that it took me to turn everything on and get this show started, I officially became unable to get his name out.
It's tough to say, but it's going to become fun to say in the future because I think this is a guy that a lot of people need to be paying attention to. I didn't think he was going to beat Paulo Thiago. I must admit, I thought Paulo Thiago's pedigree inside the UFC, you know, yeah, he was 4-3 before this fight. But he knocked out Josh Koscheck. He's fought some really game fighters. And this is Ciara Bahadurzada's first fight in the UFC. I didn't expect the level of success that we saw. 42-second knockout. And I think you'll agree with this. One of the most vicious-looking flattenings of a guy we've seen in recent memory.
Both of these guys trying to get their range going, trying to...
He was out. Bahadurzada, as Mike Goldberg said, just absolutely flatlines Paulo Thiago. And when you first looked at it, it didn't look like he really hit him with anything hard. But then they showed the replays, and as Paulo Thiago was going to the ground, he got whacked pretty solidly in the side of his head.
I made a comment earlier today. Either Paulo Thiago's chin's made of macaroni or Ciara Bahadurzada's got some legit power for a welterweight. And I think it could be a combination of both. I didn't see that punch land crisp and flush. Nevertheless, all it takes is 42 seconds. Newcomer in the UFC. That's a huge win for a guy who comes into the UFC and makes a debut. At 21-4, you've got to think that puts him close to being in the mix, as Dana likes to say. Because Paulo Thiago is a guy who, you know, honestly was right outside that mix, if not in it, a couple months ago, maybe a year ago. Interesting win for Bahadurzada. He trains with Jason Mayhem Miller, as I've mentioned on the show. It's interesting that Mayhem Miller doesn't have more evolved striking. Having seen what this guy brings to the table, I'm excited to see what, you know, what he can put together in a full fight. 42 seconds is impressive in a UFC debut. He's got to get 15 minutes under his belt against the elite welterweights in the UFC before we can really take him seriously as a title contender, I think.
And have we ever noticed Jason Miller to have really good striking skills? Because he's always been known more as a ground guy, a submission-type specialist, never really a big striker. Maybe after this fight, working with Ciara Bahadurzada...
There you go.
I'm going to say it a lot faster. It'll sound better that way. After watching this fight, does that convince him maybe to start working on his punching more or his striking more leading up to his fight with CB Dolloway?
Yes. I mean, I think CB Dolloway is a guy you can hit. Jared Hammond hit CB Dolloway. A lot of guys have been able to hit CB Dolloway. CB Dolloway's scary part of his game is his submissions because he's got a great Peruvian necktie. He's got some decent takedowns. And I think Jason Mayhem Miller is a guy who can probably just box CB Dolloway into a decision win if he wants to, but I don't know that we've seen the kind of striking out of Mayhem that would suggest he's going to go out there and put on a Michael Bisping boxing clinic. So I think you need, if you're going to have a training partner like Ciara Bahadurzada, you've got to be able to apply what you're training. And as far as having this kind of a training partner, I'm seeing Bahadurzada show off a lot of talent and a lot of power. We're not seeing it with guys he trains with. Nevertheless, he's moving up the welterweight ladder. Hopefully, Jason Mayhem Miller moves up the middleweight ladder.
Brian Stann and Alessio Sicara. That was a fight that I think we both had circled. A lot of fight fans had ready on their programs as just an out-and-out war. These two were just going to punch each other silly. We saw Brian Stann lose to Chael Sonnen and had his ground game, or complete lack thereof, it seemed, shown off for the world. Brian Stann came out in the first round and tried taking Sakara down and finally got him to the ground and then just went after him with haymakers.
Well, I think, you know, they were trading shots earlier on in that fight. I think ultimately what happened is the power of Brian Stann after dropping from light heavyweight, where he was a WEC champion, I think it's just too much for a lot of these guys. I mean, you're going to have your rare case of a guy like Chael Sonnen, who's just going to come in and be able to bully anyone in the middleweight division. I don't think a whole lot of guys can do to Brian Stann what Chael was able to do. And I think Alessio Sakara is just a guy on the wrong end of a boxing match with a guy who's got light heavyweight power. I mean, Alessio Sakara is one of the best boxers in mixed martial arts. He's got the reputation in the background as a boxer with a legit boxing career to back that up. I'm not saying he's going to go win world titles in boxing, but he's got some of the best hands as far as hand speed goes. And I thought he looked impressive in some of the exchanges with Brian Stann in the early parts of that fight. However, once Stann clips guys, that power really hits the chin, and he was able to get Sakara on the ground through that ground and pound. So Sakara went out for a little bit. I thought it was a very odd slash bad stoppage. I know that a lot of people are going to disagree with me on that. Nevertheless, Brian Stann moves up that middleweight ladder. 6-3 in the UFC now. Should be an interesting future for him.
And we do have the audio from that stoppage. Let's play that for you.
This is his first fight here in 2012.
That's it. He's out. They stopped it. It is all over.
Look at that power from all just in close. That kind of power this guy possesses. Unbelievable.
He was out for a second, came back off.
Yeah, he was. You saw when Brian Stann, he clocked him with a couple of left hands right to the side of the head. One just absolutely turned out the lights on Alessio Sakara. The second one seemed to bring him back. I called it, he was a human surge protector, where, you know, the power goes out and then just, boom, pops right back on. And at that point, he woke up, realized, oh, wait, I'm still on my back being punched in the head, went to cover up, and by that point, the ref had called it. It was done.
Well, I don't necessarily agree with that on the premise that he's on his back already. I don't see it as any different than a flash knockdown. If a guy gets hit and the lights go out, he falls to a knee or he falls all the way down. The similarity is that there's a time that lapses, seconds, a split second, whatever it is, where the guy goes out if he's going to fall all the way to the ground. It just so happens that Paulo Thiago was out for extended periods of time. Michael Bisping at UFC 100 was out for extended periods of time. But generally, you get a guy who's standing upright, he gets hit on the chin, and he falls on his face, even if momentarily the lights have gone out. Otherwise, he would still be up. So how is that any different than Alessio Sakara, who's on his back? He can't fall anywhere. He gets hit in the chin, the lights momentarily go out, they come back on, he immediately goes to defend, and the fight's over. I'm not saying it's not a good stoppage for fighter safety reasons. I just don't see how it's any different than a flash knockdown where a guy who's standing and throwing punches drops to a knee or he drops all the way to the ground and has to take more punishment. If you're out, you're out. The difference is Alessio Sakara had nowhere to go and was looking right up at the referee. But let's not pretend there's not similarities between guys going out and guys going out. The difference is Alessio Sakara had a big, strong middleweight with punching power on top of him, and the ref could actually see his eyes roll back. I guarantee you, if you look at Frankie Edgar's fight with Gray Maynard, you look at some of these other fights, check Congo against Pat Barry. You can't tell me that those guys weren't out momentarily. They were allowed to continue, and on that premise, I don't really see why the fight was stopped so soon. I don't have a problem if we're all going to talk about fighter safety and how Alessio Sakara could have eaten a lot more damage from Brian Stann, and he would have, and the fight probably would have been stopped in 10 to 15 seconds. That being said, I don't really agree with the stoppage today on the fight card because he did cover up quickly, and though he was out, everyone who gets knocked down is out at some point. Otherwise, they'd be standing straight up.
Yeah, we'd have been looking at a situation of the Pat Curran-Joe Warren fight from about 6 weeks ago in Bellator, where that fight should have been stopped at least 15 seconds faster than it was. Is this coming to a point now where we need to see more stringent refereeing, where everybody has an exact line of things that they're looking at? Because you mentioned the Frankie Edgar fight, you mentioned the Pat Barry fight. those were different referees than we had today. I believe it was Mark Goodman was our referee.
Might have been Mark Goddard.
Mark Goddard, that's the one. Excuse me, I don't know where I get my name sometimes. Mark Goddard might have seen things differently than Herb Dean sees things, than Josh Rosenthal sees things, than Steve Mazzagatti sees things, but who doesn't on that one? Are we getting to a point again where we're going to start having conversations about refereeing in MMA?
Well, I mean, it's gonna constantly come up because, like refereeing in any sport where it's balls and strikes that are being argued in baseball, or charges and, you know, personal fouls called in basketball, there's a fine line between how you define, you know, human judgment and human error when it comes to these judgments. And you watch a fight like Joe Warren and Pat Curran, and you sit there and you go, he took too much damage. He was clearly out on the feet, and, you know, it should have been stopped a lot sooner. And then you see a fight like today and you go, okay, the ref stepped in and maybe he stepped in at the right time, blah, blah, blah. My problem is that there's a huge discrepancy between these stoppages, and I don't know that that can be rectified. I mean, you have guys, Herb Dean's going to give guys opportunity to fight back. Maybe Mark Goddard doesn't feel like he needs to put fighters at risk. I can only speak to, I think you need to pay attention to a fighter's history. If you're a referee, I know that that's probably not part of what you're told to do as far as, you know, treat these guys fairly and equally, blah, blah, blah. You see a guy like Houston Alexander get clipped numerous times and go out. I'm sorry, he doesn't have the same kind of leeway in these fights. If he gets clipped, you have to think about his safety. However, if you see a guy who's notoriously taking beatings, you've got to allow him the opportunity to fight back from some of this stuff because he's proven track record-wise and on a resume, he's capable of taking it and coming back and weathering the storm. Today, you know, I mean, I don't think it was a great stoppage, but it was a much better stoppage situation than the Curran-Warren fight, or even let's go back to King Mo against Lorenz Larkin, where the female referee allowed Lorenz Larkin to take 15 uncontested shots to the head.
Kim Winslow, referee of the year.
Kim Winslow can't allow guys to take that kind of punishment. 15 unanswered shots, okay, is a lot worse than one shot that puts a guy out momentarily because it's 15 times the amount of damage.
Well, I'm looking at Alessio Sakara's history here. He's lost 4 times by knockout. The last time that he was knocked out was by Chris Lieben in March of 2008. So it's been 4 years, literally 4 years since this guy's been knocked out. Yeah, he probably could have eaten a little more punishment, but you're right. For safety's sake, it was probably the better idea. Discretion is the better part of valor in stopping that fight. And he moves on to who knows what's going to come next for Alessio Sakara and for Brian Stann, who goes back to trying to step back up that ladder in that division. Our main event on Fuel was Alexander Gustafsson and Thiago Silva, a guy that Kenny Florian said on the broadcast multiple times absolutely scared him. Gustafsson had, obviously, the hometown crowd in Sweden behind him, clipped Silva early with a good uppercut. After that, it was a good back-and-forth type of fight, 30-27, 30-27, 29-28. Gustafsson, your winner by unanimous decision. Was that the kind of fight that really, you know, elevates Alexander Gustafsson up the rankings?
Do you want a long answer or a short answer? If you want the long answer, no.
I can give you an answer that might contradict you.
Okay, go for it. Let's hear it.
Dan Henderson's waiting in the wings. We're going to get through Atlanta next week. Rashad versus Jones. We're going to get through that. Dan Henderson's going to go. We'll see who's next. And I think in the meanwhile, Gustafsson's going to have time to have a fight.
Exactly. I'd like to see it kind of shuffled around a little bit and give Gustafsson a shot because you look at the top 8, a lot of them have fought for a title. And if you give Gustafsson a chance, maybe he can ruffle a little feathers.
So you're saying no tune-up. You'd like to see him against John or Rashad.
I'd like to see him. He's young and he can fight, man. He can do it.
That was Mark Munoz on the UFC on Fuel post-fight show. Chael Sonnen, you know, mentioning that Dan Henderson is next in line in the light heavyweight division after Rashad Evans and John Jones next week. But Mark Munoz declaring that Alexander Gustafsson deserves a title shot because the other 8 guys ahead of him, they had a top 10 ranking and he was 9th. He deserves a shot because the other eight guys have already fought for a title.
Here's, I have numerous holes, machine gun style, I want to shoot through that. First things first, as you like to say, Alexander Gustafsson is not a top 10 light heavyweight. And I'm sorry if anybody thinks that they're not paying attention to who's been winning fights and who's been losing fights. Secondly, Thiago Silva is a good fighter, I guess, maybe in a way. But he's coming off of his first fight since a year-long suspension. He actually hasn't fought in, let's say, 15 months before this, and his last fight was a no contest against Brandon Vera, a fight that was turned into a no contest because he was suspended for steroid use.
Before, after he mashed Brandon Vera's nose in.
Right.
That was fun.
Before that fight, he lost to Rashad Evans. So this guy hasn't won since 2009. We're just talking about Thiago Silva here. Thiago Silva's last victory was against Keith Jardine.
Woo!
His three biggest victories of his career, Keith Jardine, Houston Alexander, and James Irvin. Three guys with no chin, okay? He knocked all three of them out. Surprise, surprise. He's lost to Lyoto Machida, Rashad Evans, and Alexander Gustafsson in his career. Those are his three losses. Thiago Silva's not a guy that you use as a stepping stone towards a title shot. He's not even a guy you use as a stepping stone towards a top five opponent, especially with his recent resume and how it looks with loss, no contest loss. I think it's egregious for someone of Mark Munoz's intelligence to suggest that a win over Thiago Silva makes anybody worthy of a title shot. And, I don't have a problem with Alexander Gustafsson. He draws comparisons to John Jones. Maybe some of those comparisons make sense as far as age, height, weight, and all that cute stuff is concerned. But he doesn't have a ton of great wins. I mean, Thiago Silva, Vladimir Matyushenko, Matt Hamill, James Tahuna is a good win as we see James Tahuna move up the light heavyweight ladder. Cyril Diabaty, he's also putting away guys like Jared Hammond, but he drops a submission, to Phil Davis. Not a guy who can get past Phil Davis. Phil Davis challenged Rashad Evans. This is all too premature. I mean, the kid's 25. He looks like he could put on 20 pounds of muscle and compete at heavyweight in the next couple years. Let's give him time before we start ushering him in as a contender ahead of Dan Henderson. I mean, Dan Henderson beat Fedor Emelianenko. Dan Henderson has knocked out Rafael Cavalcante. He's beaten the best guys at light heavyweight, at middleweight, and he beat the best heavyweight of all time. Alexander Gustafsson doesn't leapfrog a guy like that because he beat Thiago Silva. I like Mark Munoz, but that makes no sense.
And one last thing on Gustafsson. We're talking here about whether he deserves a top five guy or where this vaults him in the light heavyweight rankings. He says he wants a top five guy. I mean, why not give him one? And if so, who's he going to get?
I would consider Lyoto Machida, if that's something he'd be interested in. Otherwise, I think the appropriate fight for him is the guy who unfortunately could not take the fight due to injury, and that's Lil Nog. I think that's an appropriate fight for him. It's a good gauge of where his striking acumen is. Thiago Silva has put away a lot of solid strikers with no chin, and he was able to use that power, but he doesn't have... I don't necessarily think of Thiago Silva as having a great striking game so much as he has some power in his hands. Lil Nog's a little bit different. I think Lil Nog poses some problems on the feet. I think he's got a decent enough game on the ground that Gustafsson will want to stay away. And it's an interesting style clash. I think that Gustafsson is going to be able to work and be more athletic than a lot of the guys in the division that he'll face. So I think Machida is a guy who, if he wants to kind of get in there and take on a big name opponent, I think Machida's apropos. I just don't think he deserves someone bigger than that.
Why not Phil Davis? They last fought 2 years ago, UFC 112. Phil Davis is coming off the loss to Rashad Evans, his first professional loss. On paper, this would look like one heck of a matchup of two young, up-and-coming guys, and it's a rematch which the UFC loves. Fans tend to love it, especially after the amount of time that they've been away from each other. Why not Gustafsson Davis too? If they can't cobble together Machida or Little Nog?
Well, I don't know. I mean, Davis put away Gustafsson pretty easily, I thought, in that fight. An anaconda chokes in the first round, no less, is not something that you forget. And I Phil Davis is probably not where Alexander Gustafsson has evolved to. I mean, I think if we're talking about contenders, I think Phil Davis has kind of fallen off that perch a little bit. Here's my take on all of this stuff coming out on Alexander Gustafsson and what he wants and where he sits. This is really the UFC pushing somebody in our face as fans, as a challenger not named Rashad Evans or Dan Henderson, because after those two fights for John Jones, if John Jones has those fights, there's nobody left. I mean, there's just nobody left for John Jones to face. He's beaten Rampage. He's beaten Shogun. He's not going to have to fight Machida ever again because he just took down Machida. Forrest Griffin's not a guy who's going to climb his way back all the way to the top unless a guy comes out of nowhere and really, really, you know, even maybe out of Strikeforce. I don't know.
Luke Rockhold
could be a guy that wants to put on 20 pounds and do it, but he's fighting at middleweight right now. Who is there? I mean, who is there to face John Jones? Alexander Gustafsson is only 14-1. He's 25. This has become a big deal because there's a depleted division that doesn't have any challengers. You want to talk about, you know, Mark Munoz says, let's leapfrog him over 9 guys who've had a shot. He's not completely inaccurate that a lot of the other guys ahead of Gustafsson have lost. Unfortunately, that doesn't mean Gustafsson has earned the title shot. He's not Dan Hardy. This isn't welterweight. You don't just move ahead from the number 14 ranking to number 2 because people enjoyed watching you beat up Thiago Silva in Sweden. I mean, that's not how the UFC should work. I think he deserves Machida, maybe Lil Nog. Aside from that, you know, man, get back in line. Fight the guys they tell you to fight, whether that's Forrest, whether that's anybody you have to, because Thiago Silva is not a win that gets you title shots.
So there's your UFC on Fuel 2 card, your Fight of the Night bonus, Brad Pickett and Damasio Page, your Submission of the Night bonus, John McGuire, for that armbar against Demarcus Johnson, and your Knockout of the Night, C.R. Badaherzada over Paulo Thiago with that 42-second bomb that he dropped on him. Last night, Bellator 65, we saw the Bantamweight tournament begin, Marcus Galvao over Ed West by a unanimous decision, and Luis Nogueira over Alexis Villa by unanimous decision. Alexis Villa is 41 years old. How much more does he have in the tank?
I don't know, but whatever is left should not be spent competing at 135 pounds. I thought that was evident. Luis Nogueira, he's a good size 135er, and he was able to bully Alexis Villa a little bit. It was an interesting fight. I saw why the judges gave it to Nogueira 29-28 across the board, and because of that, it's a disappointing, you know, showing for the former Olympian. I don't know at his age with his gas tank if he's going to be able to make waves at 135. Either Bellator needs to add a flyweight division or Alexis Villa needs to get himself into the UFC and compete against guys his own size, because I don't think he's outmatched talent-wise. He just doesn't seem to be able to bully anybody at 135. He drops his second fight in a row.
Speaking of guys at 135, we had our bantamweight championship fight between Eduardo Dantas and Zach Makovsky, and Eduardo Dantas just kind of pulled off a little something in what we were looking at was apparently close to Makovsky's hometown in New Jersey.
Now going for the head and arm choke.
Sean, I am stunned.
And there you have Eduardo Dudu Dantas is your new Bellator bantamweight champion. What kind of a chance would someone like Alexis Villa have against him?
I don't know. I think he's style-wise, I think Alexis Villa is going to have a problem with a guy who's as long and lanky as Eduardo Dantas. Dantas is the guy who, to me, for 135ers, is easily just snuck himself into the top 10. I say that for a couple of reasons. One, I think his height and his length poses a lot of problems for dudes. He doesn't have great striking, but he threw some body kicks. I don't know if you saw them against Zach Makovsky.
Oh, yeah.
They would make a lot of dudes that size crumble. And Zach Makovsky didn't look like he enjoyed taking them. those kind of kicks from a guy like Dontis are really, really solid. Even if the hands aren't necessarily developed, he's a 23-year-old kid. I think there's a lot of room for him to grow. On the ground, you know, I don't know how many guys at 135 can beat him. I'll be honest. I think he's a legit threat to anybody in the UFC's bantamweight division. You know, give him 2 years as far as facing top-level competition in Bellator. I think he's a guy you could put in there against Uriah Faber or Dominic Cruz and expect positive results from, if not wins, because you know he's an up-and-comer. He's got great submissions. He's a fast kid, long limbs, and I expected him to pull off that victory. I did not expect him to look that impressive.
And then we had the featherweight tournament semifinal. Daniel Strauss and Mike Corey, another unanimous decision win, but Daniel Strauss just kind of waltzed over Corey, and he's moving on to take on Marlon Sandro.
Daniel Strauss is a guy, I've said it a couple times, and when I said it, I was a little bit nervous about it because it's one of those predictions that you really can't know too much about. It's everything that happens in Bellator needs to be taken with a grain of salt when you're comparing stuff to the UFC. However, I believe Daniel Strauss is a guy that, you know, 12 to 15 months from now, can compete with the best featherweights in the UFC. I'm talking Jose Aldo. And what's interesting about that to me, he's going to have an opportunity to face a Jose Aldo teammate in the final of the Season 6 featherweight tournament in Bellator in Marlon Sandro. And I that's a really interesting fight for me. I think it's a fight you're geeked about. I know it's a fight I'm excited for. Daniel Strauss has got really, really good striking. Good left hook. Good jab. He's got a nice right hand. And he's strong. And so I think he matches up with Marlon Sandro really well. And I think if he gets by a teammate of Jose Aldo, who's, you know, to me, they're very similar in a lot of ways and very dissimilar in ways. But if Strauss can pass this test and clear this hurdle, you know, he's going to get his shot at the Bellator featherweight champion. And while that is something on its own, if I'm projecting Daniel Strauss right now into the UFC, I think he's close to a top 10 featherweight status, if not already in. It just looked absolutely dominant and impressive against Mike Corey at Bellator 65.
There's a reason we're not telling you about the heavyweight championship fight between Eric Prindle and Cole Conrad. Eric Prindle, trouble just follows him wherever he goes anymore. Not legal trouble, not anything like that. He's snake bitten right now with all the mess that he had. Just getting his title shot, and now he hurts his hand, I believe it was, and they had to postpone his fight with Cole Conrad for another month, so we're going to do that at Bellator 70. Was there anything on the, you know, on our prelim cards that we had? Because we had a couple really good prelim cards as well between these two cards this weekend. Anything that really stood out to you?
Yes. I mean, obviously, you got guys from France making waves in the UFC. Cyril Diabaty comes back in a fight that he was taken down in the first round. I think most people thought that's just it because he doesn't have a great ground game. He's a 6'6" light heavyweight who's, in my opinion, I don't know how many people will agree with this, but my personal opinion, he's one of the five best strikers in the UFC. Pound for pound, he's got a great kickboxing background, excuse me. And he just lights guys up on the feet. He lit up Tom DeBlas on the feet tonight, was taken down, fought his way back, took a close decision. Francis Carmont is a guy who, I think if you've got a guy at middleweight who has a chance to compete and have the Anderson Silva titles attached to him in the next couple of years, I think it's this kid. He's just athletic as all hell. I'm really excited about his career arc and his future progression. Other guys on the card that I thought were impressive, Reza Madadi looked great, locking up a guillotine choke. And Simeon Thorason's an interesting guy. He's a 6'3" welterweight with a 79-inch reach. And he was able to put together a rear naked choke submission, lock up a win against Besim Youssef in the second round. I thought he was losing the fight until he was able to get that submission. I believe he moves to 17-2 in his career. An interesting, unique fighter in the welterweight division, which is fast becoming the deepest division in mixed martial arts. A lot of fun undercard fights this weekend.
And we also had over in Bellator, UFC alumnus Chris McCray, you know, the Savage, as they called him on his season of The Ultimate Fighter. He comes out with a win over Ailton Barboza, a split decision win. And then a guy in a welterweight tournament qualifier that we've been talking about recently, Lyman Good, just absolutely nukes LaVon Maynard with a first-round knockout.
Good, the former Bellator welterweight world champion. He's in the black trunks. LaVon Maynard in the red trunks. Kevin Mulhall, the referee, round number one.
This might be over quickly, Sean.
Very fast start by Lyman Good, looking for the ground and pound finish, and he gets it! Just like that, a lightning strike win for the former champion of 170 pounds.
Yeah, it was 13 seconds. That's all it took. And that shouldn't come as a shock to anybody. Lyman Good is a former champion in Bellator, a guy that can compete with any welterweight they put in that tournament, and just a lights-out solid performance, probably the best individual performance all weekend.
That's Marcus Schmidley from MMAInterviews.tv. I'm Kevin Mendelsohn. That's round one. We are the MMA Cutmen. When we come back, we're going to have your headlines of the week. Anything you may have missed in MMA. Still kind of a slow week, even though we did have a fight week. There is stuff outside the cage to tell you about, and we'll do that next with the MMA Cutmen. Welcome back. This is round two. We are the MMA Cutmen. I'm Kevin Mendelsohn. That's Marcus Schmidley. And here are your MMA headlines of the week. Christiane Cyborg Santos, the former Strikeforce women's champion, she's still suspended. She did not get her... She had her appeal heard by the California State Athletic Commission. She was trying to get it cut down from a year to 6 months. They said no. She's still suspended. She won't be back in action until at least December.
Yeah, well, I don't think that should come as a surprise to a whole lot of people. You get busted for taking steroids, and your excuse is to kind of just blame everybody else. I don't know if she's the kind of person that's going to have a whole lot of success getting stuff like this turned around. She's the best female mixed martial arts, you know, in my opinion, on the planet. And I think when her suspension's up, she's not going to have a hard time proving that to people. Right now, however, she's going to have to sit out a while. Hopefully she can train up. And a year's time, we're going to get to see Ronda Rousey against Cyborg.
Now, the nice thing, though, about Christiane Cyborg was that she didn't come out and take the I didn't mean to do, or I didn't take this knowingly, or make any kind of excuses. She came out and said, I made a mistake, I screwed up and I put this stuff in my body. And that's, I think, why she was thinking that it would go be cut in half to 6 months. The commission just kind of looked at her and went, look, you made a mistake. Guess what? You're paying the full price for your action. Thanks for your honesty. We appreciate the apology as well, but you're going to go ahead and get a year.
It's interesting. We live in a world where admitting you made a mistake gets you a year in MMA purgatory, and denying that you've either done something wrong or that a test failed you, as it was the case in Alistair Overeem's world, means that there's a good chance you're still fighting at your next heavyweight title fight against Junior Dos Santos. I find that, you know, it's an ominous tone for us set that when people come forward and they admit wrongdoing, they get popped pretty hard. But a guy like Alistair Overeem, who, you know, we don't have any reason to suspect that he didn't test positive for steroids, otherwise there wouldn't be controversy, has found a way to wiggle himself into a situation where he's got UFC support, hasn't been pulled from that card yet. And you know, at this point, we talked about it last week. We were ready to pull him from that card. A week went by, nothing happened. He may still end up fighting on that card. Just unique to see the parallel differences between those two.
So what you're saying is, if Chris Cyborg had come out and said, oh no, that wasn't me, it has to be a false positive, she would still be the Strikeforce women's champion and may have had a fight recently as well.
I don't know if that's the case for this main reason. Alistair Overeem makes the UFC a ton of money when he fights. That is, and also this, and this is going to come as a shock to a lot of listeners when they hear this. The Nevada State Athletic Commission, for anybody listening, makes money on live gates and pay-per-view numbers. That's an interesting bit of knowledge there. They make money, percentages, on live gates and pay-per-views. Meaning, if Alistair Overeem brings a lot of fans into the MGM Grand or Caesar's Palace or wherever the fight's being held, and pay-per-view numbers are great because it's a heavyweight title fight, the Nevada State Athletic Commission loses money by not allowing Alistair Overeem to compete at the event. So in a way, they're going to be cutting off their nose to spite their face if they do the right thing. That's why there's a bit of a hang-up here. I don't know that a whole lot of people are aware of that situation. And there's a conflict of interest there, and I don't know how it's going to be handled. I don't think a whole lot of people do. But it's interesting that that's a fact. And on top of it, Cyborg Santos fights in a organization that's, it's just Walking Dead. And I don't think anyone really cares what happens to her at this point.
Yeah, the UFC, or Zuffa, excuse me, is treating Strikeforce like the quote-unquote minor leagues. You still have guys like Jorge Masvidal. You still have Gilbert Melendez and Josh Thompson and Luke Rockhold competing there. But that's just because they don't feel that they're ready for the UFC. They can't make them the most money there.
Well, there's plenty of major league fighters over in Strikeforce. You know that. I know that. Everyone else knows that watches the Strikeforce fights. But the thing is, those guys are either contractually obligated to fight over there, or they're just stuck because Dana White doesn't really feel like bringing him over. Gilbert Melendez, Josh Thompson, Luke Rockhold, Jacare Souza, you can honestly tell me those guys don't want to fight against UFC competition on UFC cards? They'd love to. They would have loved to have been in a packed house in Sweden tonight. They'd have loved to have fought in the MGM Grand on a UFC card, but they're not getting that opportunity. The Strike Force has become a superfluous act. I don't think anyone cares anymore. And Cyborg Santos doesn't make Dana White any money because he doesn't really like women's MMA. That's why there's a difference between the most dominant female specimen in all of mixed martial arts and the most physically dominant male specimen in all of mixed martial arts. It all comes down to money.
Something else you may have missed this week, this just popped up a couple of days ago. The California State Athletic Commission in the news for another reason. They're giving fighters a chance at some point, maybe, we think, I don't know, the therapeutic use exemption. So basically, if you're Alistair Overeem and you're popped for steroid use because it's over the legal limit, so you can still have your limit, but if it stays at a level playing field, you can appeal to the commission to get that license in order to still be able to fight. Nick Diaz, with his medical marijuana problems, I want to take an aside with this medical marijuana stuff. I don't smoke weed. I know plenty of people that do. I don't care if you smoke pot or not. Have fun. But unless your name is Kobayashi or one of these guys in the major league eating competitions, weed is not a performance-enhancing drug. And feel free to tell me that I'm wrong on our Facebook page, facebook.com/TheMMACutman. Nick Diaz, I understand he has ADD, and I'm sure that pot will mellow him out before a fight. But you want to have that controlled rage if you're going to be doing something like mixed martial arts. You don't smoke pot before a fight to get amped up, to give you an advantage over somebody else.
Here's the other side to that coin, and I don't really have a whole lot to say on this subject because I think, frankly, it's a little bit ridiculous that the California State Athletic Commission is even doing this. If you or I go out to our car right now, and we go to our glove compartment, and we bring out a big, fat bag of weed,
woo!
And we walk back to the studio, and on our way, we end up coming across a police officer. What happens in a situation like that?
You throw the weed in a bush and run.
Oh, what actually happens in a situation like that?
You get in some trouble, sir.
Oh, that's interesting. So you're saying it might be illegal to possess marijuana and potentially smoke it. That's interesting. I think if it's illegal
to do something... This is California, though.
Well, agreed. And I know that there are medical marijuana, cards and whatnot. I've seen enough Entourage. I know how you get one of those things. But if it's illegal in real life, why isn't it illegal in mixed martial arts? Why is it okay for Nick Diaz to do something because he's got a medical reason to do it? Look, I'm not going to make light of Nick Diaz's problems. He's obviously a guy who has social anxiety. Don't we all have issues? I mean, I could fabricate a reason with my various handicaps that I need medical marijuana. However, I don't because I guess maybe I have some sort of moral problem with it. And I'm not going to play that card as to why someone else shouldn't do it. That's a personal preference. However, the truth is, if you and I go out to our cars and grab marijuana and we get popped for it, bad things happen. So how is it that all of a sudden Nick Diaz isn't in trouble because he got busted and tested positive for having marijuana samples in his urine? You know, having the right to do something and actually doing it, not telling people you were doing it, being lack, having a lack of intelligence and then getting caught. You know, this whole thing to me smacks of, look, we want guys in California to feel comfortable about their recreational drug use, so we're going to pass a law that allows combat athletes to do whatever they do, and they don't have to deal with the consequences, and that's just how we're going to cover up trying to change the culture of mixed martial artists and what they do in their spare time. You don't have to smoke pot to be a successful fighter. Ask Carlos Condit what he does on his spare time. I mean, I guess my issue with this is that it's even being passed. You know, you want to pass a thing for TRT, be my guest. I'm sure there are guys that may actually need TRT.
Here's the funny thing. It could take 6 months to 2 years to get any kind of passing of this amendment into a law in California.
Well, it's something that I think everyone is going to have to pay attention to. You know, Executive Director George Dodd is going to be trying to get this thing taken care of so that it becomes California, you know, Athletic Commission law. And I don't really have a whole lot else to add on this. I understand that it's happening, and I understand that there are people that would like to see marijuana off a banned substance list. And I get that if there's any state that's going to be lenient about that kind of stuff, it's going to be California. I don't necessarily have to agree with it or like it, but I understand why it's happening. Hopefully, this doesn't catch on. I don't really think we need all 50 states that legalize mixed martial arts, or however many states legalize mixed martial arts right now. We don't really need all of them making it so that fighters can get high days before their fights because it's okay according to, you know, state athletic commissions. One state's one thing. I'd hope that this doesn't spread.
Okay, and again, if you have any way to, or any thoughts to debate us with on this subject or anything else, you can always hit our Facebook page, The MMA Cutman, on Facebook. Our last little bit for headlines this week.
Hector, I kill you!
He won't be doing that anytime soon. Alexander Shlemenko, unfortunately, was in a car accident this past week in Russia. Broken collarbone and a dislocated thumb. He's going to be out of action for at least 6 months.
I'm a big fan of Alexander Shlemenko. I think he's got some of the most exciting kickboxing in mixed martial arts. There's this idea that because he's in Bellator and he's a recent tournament winner, that he's a guy who could step into the UFC and compete against some of the best middleweights out there. I don't know if I buy that, but he is 45-7. He's 7-1 in Bellator. And there is news coming down that if Hector Lombard steps out of Bellator and is a free agent and decides he no longer wants to fight for the organization, that Alexander Shlemenko is going to be given a vacant title opportunity against someone else. And that's an interesting situation for Shlemenko, who just, you know, suffered a broken collarbone, lacerations to his hand, and a possible broken thumb in a car accident. Let me ask you, if Bellator is an organization centered around having tournaments that dictate who fights for titles, why would they go out of their way to set this up like this?
Well, it looks like they're giving Alexander Shlemenko, the Season 5 tournament winner, his title shot that he has earned. And if Hector Lombard leaves, then that leaves them with an open title, and they've got a Season 6 tournament going on right now. So then they would have two guys that have won tournaments that would be getting the title shot anyways. I don't know why Alexander Shlemenko has not gotten his title shot yet. Maybe it's because of the contract hiccups with Hector Lombard. But there's your guy that was due a title shot to begin with. And then you're taking the next guy that's due a title shot. And boom, you're killing two birds with one stone. You're getting the two title shots out of the way, and you're filling a title vacancy.
Is that a fight, though, that you want to see? I mean, honestly, do you want to see Alexander Shlemenko against Brian Rogers, Bruno Santos, Michael Falco, or Vyacheslav Vasilevsky? I mean, let's be honest. Without Hector Lombard, this division doesn't have the same kind of pop. Are people going to tune in when people aren't tuning in for Ben Askren? People aren't tuning in for all these other great fights? Do you want to sit down and watch a vacant title fight between the Season 5 champ and the Season 6 champ for the middleweight strap?
Well, I would, because I just want to see more fights, but unfortunately the casual fan that's going to pop the ratings on MTV2, that's going to put more money in the Bellator coffers, probably not. But then, do we put the blame on Hector Lombard for refusing to accept a new deal?
Well, no. I mean, Hector Lombard has to do what's in his best interest and what puts food on his family's table. I don't have any issue with Hector Lombard going, I've done all I can do in Bellator. There are no other challengers for me at 30, you know, 31, 2-1. I haven't lost in Bellator. I'm 8-0. I want to fight UFC dudes. You know, that would be my thought process. He wants to graduate from the minor leagues to the big leagues. That's great. That's perfect. I guess I just don't understand the thought process behind we're just going to gift Shlemenko an opportunity when, A, he's just going to be getting back from all these, you know, injuries, this car accident, drunk driver hits him, all that stuff. Can't we just kind of chill out? I mean, Bellator needs to just get through season six, get their ratings up, have these quality fights before they start making public statements that throw Hector Lombard under a bus. He hasn't even signed up for the UFC yet, and they're already saying, if he leaves us, we've already got plan B in effect. I mean, if you're Hector Lombard, aren't you reading that going,
sweet, I'm out of here.
Guess they don't need me very much. Yeah. They've already got something figured out. I don't understand how that's good business for Bellator. Having Hector Lombard on your roster is a heck of a lot better than not having Hector Lombard on your roster.
And that's round two. Those are your MMA headlines for the week. I'm Kevin Mendelsohn. That's Marcus Schmidley. We'll be back with round three. If you are going to be watching any MMA this weekend, we're going to tell you what fights you want to be looking for. Bellator's got a stacked card. The UFC returns to pay-per-view for their first time in about 2 months. We're going to tell you all about those cards coming up next. We're the MMA Cutmen. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is round three. We are the MMA Cutmen. I'm Kevin Mendelsohn, along with Marcus Schmidley.
What's up?
How you doing?
I'm doing pretty good.
Awesome. You ready to get into some UFC and Bellator previews?
Breaking down next week's fight cards, there's a ton of stuff to talk about. I'm excited. I think I'm more excited about Bellator 66. Maybe that's just because I love Bellator talk, but a lot of good fights, and I think the headliner is just as good as the UFC 145 headliner.
I think you're also a big fan of Japanese MMA, and Bellator 66 is going to be capped off by one of the biggest stars in Japanese MMA, Shinya Aoki, a rematch about 3.5 years in the making with Eddie Alvarez. That's going to be a hell of a fight.
I'm excited. I don't know if Eddie Alvarez is excited. I think the city of Cleveland is going to get their money's worth when Shinya Aoki goes in there, rips off Eddie Alvarez's foot, and says, thank you, Cleveland. I done now. And that will be it. You will see.
Will he walk in and go, hello, Cleveland?
Cleveland rocks.
That might.
Cleveland rocks.
Yeah.
Oh.
Drew Carey should be out here at Sounders Games. He owns them.
That notwithstanding.
we've derailed.
Eddie Alvarez is a really tough out. And I don't know if Shinya Aoki is the kind of guy who, yes, 3.5 years ago he had success. This is a different Eddie Alvarez. He has about 5 more kids now. He's that much more motivated. And I think that not training in a cage is going to hurt Shinya Aoki. I know he had a hard time with Gil Melendez. Gil Melendez, to me, is a better fighter than Eddie Alvarez. But Eddie Alvarez is a top 5 lightweight, in my opinion. And Shinya Aoki is a top 10 lightweight. So it's one of those fights, rare fight, that we get to see that's not in a UFC or a Strikeforce card, where you legitimately have two of the best guys on the planet competing, and their styles are so different. I'm so geeked for that fight.
Now, what brought Shinya Aoki? Of course, we've seen him in Dream countless times. We saw him in Strikeforce with Gilbert Melendez. What brings him from Strikeforce down to Bellator? Is it just a sort of thing that Zuffa didn't want to bring him back in, or he's doing this kind of on his own, or what's kind of the impetus for this?
Well, I think the main theme of this show and what we're dissecting is that this comes down, like everything in mixed martial arts, to money. I don't know that necessarily Shinya Aoki competing on Bellator is something that I would have thought would happen a year ago.
Luckily, he's not just waltzing into a tournament. That would be a complete joke.
Right. I'm a fan of him competing against a guy like Eddie Alvarez because I think Eddie Alvarez hasn't had this level of competition during his stay in Bellator. I'm a fan of Shinya Aoki competing against a guy who's not Rich Clemente or just a middle-of-the-pack lightweight. I think he taps a good percentage of everyone in the UFC who's not a top 5, top 10 guy. It's a fight that needs to happen because I think both guys need the competition. Dream doesn't really exist in the same way that it used to. To my knowledge, they haven't had a fight card even established. I mean, we haven't, you know, we scoured the internet looking for upcoming fights for Dream. You know, I know Deep is doing their thing over there in Japan. A lot of good fight cards, you know, Shooto and whatnot, there's no mention of an upcoming dream card, and I think that's one of the reasons this fight's taking place on MTV2 and Bellator 66 in Cleveland. Shinya Aoki might just be running out of venues and places he can fight.
Yeah, Dream continuing to have probably monetary issues. I know that was their major theme for most of last year, and that's why we really didn't see anything until the traditional New Year's Eve card. But hopefully Dream gets back on track and but then again, maybe not, because we want to see these Japanese fighters venture back into the United States. And I know a lot of fight fans that don't know these guys are just going to be blown away by some of the talent coming over.
Well, you mentioned at the top of the segment, you know, why this stop for Shinya Aoki is there a reason the UFC wouldn't be interested? And I think it's a fair question. I don't know that he's the kind of fighter that Dana White wants on the roster. For a variety of reasons, namely Dana White hasn't had a huge success with Japanese fighters. But more importantly, he reminds me a lot of Damian Maya in a way, where you've got a very accomplished grappler. And if he gets away from that grappling, he's not going to be in interesting fights. Yet people want him to develop a game outside of that grappling. For whatever reason, Damian Maya was coaxed into this idea that you have to be a well-rounded mixed martial artist to compete at middleweight and welterweight and all these different weight classes in the UFC. And if you're not a well-rounded fighter, you're just not up to par. He was tapping dudes using his grappling, and I think Shinya Aoki is a guy who can tap any lightweight out there. But Dana White has to want a one-dimensional grappler in the UFC at lightweight for his competitors. I don't know that that's necessarily someone he's going to go out of his way to sign. I don't know that Shinya comes cheap, and I think that's where there's a hang-up. Again, money. Money seems to be a prevailing theme on this show. Shinya Aoki's not a guy who's going to accept a $12,000, you know, three-fight contract per fight. You know, he's a $50,000-plus fighter. That's just the headline of that fight card. There's a lot of other good fights to talk about at Bellator 66. A lot of great European prospects on the preliminary card with Attila Vegh and Marcus Vatanen. It's an interesting fight card, and you can speak a little bit to the middleweight and lightweight tournament semifinals.
Well, and as we saw, going back to the preliminary card for a second, as we saw today in Sweden, these European fighters, they bring it, man. They'll come at you with everything. They want to get their names out there. They want to put on a show, and this is their way to do it.
Well, the training is always in question. The gas tank is always in question, and sometimes the weight cutting. I think a lot of guys, Japan and Europe fight, and I guess you could say, you know, mainland Asia, they're fighting out of their weight classes. You look at a guy like Kazuo Masaki, who's used to competing at middleweight, even though he looked really good at welterweight. So he's fighting 15 pounds higher than maybe he should. And I think that's an issue with European fighters as well. However, that being said, I think there are a lot of prospects that if they get a chance at Bellator or the UFC and they're young enough and they can develop with good training and they get into the right divisions, I think you see a guy like Alexander Gustafsson, Simeon Thorsson on the undercard of today's UFC fights in Sweden. There's a lot of guys out of Europe, and maybe one of these two gentlemen, Vegh or Vantanen, is going to be one of those guys that just jumps out, wins a fight impressively, hops onto a tournament, and starts making waves in Bellator.
And going back to the main card, we do have the semifinals for both the middleweight tournament and the lightweight tournament. In that middleweight tournament, you're going to have Brian Rogers and Bruno Santos in the first fight, Michael Falco and Vyacheslav Vasilevsky in the other one. The lightweight tournament, Rick Hahn and Lloyd Woodard, who both put on very impressive performances in their quarterfinal matchups. And then Thiago Michel and Brent Weedman in the second semifinal. The Hahn-Woodard fight we talked about a while back could actually have been the final of this tournament had Bellator drawn it the right way.
Right, and I agree with that 100%. I think that's your final. I think those are the two best fighters in the tournament. Lloyd Woodard looked absolutely great in his last fight. Just a sublime performance for him. He kind of comes out of nowhere, shocks everybody, and puts together that performance. Rick Hahn is a guy dropping down from welterweight. Yeah, I think he's a guy who's going to sneak in to these lightweight tournaments in Bellator as the prohibitive favorite every time because he's just so solid, and he cut down from a weight class. You're noticing this season is interesting because there's a lot of good, you know, competitors competing in weight classes they had, and we talk about, you know, Brian Baker. We talk about a lot of these guys who are cutting into new divisions. Rick Hahn, one of the best, looked good in his last fight. He's going to have a chance to move to the final against Lloyd Woodard. Thiago Michel, Brett Weidman. Interesting fight. Unique style clash. I don't see either one of those guys making much waves past this fight. But then again, you know, that's why they fight them, and they're not just done on paper. Anybody has a chance to win these fights.
And over in the middleweights, like we talked about, Rogers and Santos, Falcao and Vasilevsky. Vasilevsky still having his problems with M1 Global owning his contract and that whole mess, but he's still going to be out there. I'm kind of looking at Michael Falcao as the prohibitive favorite to move on not only to the final, but also to win this middleweight tournament.
Well, I like Brian Rogers. I thought his violence in his first fight with the flying knee knockout was very impressive. I think he's the guy to watch out for. I you know, Bruno Santos isn't a guy I think he should take lightly. However, of all the guys in the competition, he's also probably the least, you know, noticed. He's probably the guy who isn't being taken as seriously. I think Vasilevsky's a wild card in this thing. I don't think a whole lot of people know enough about him. And it'll be interesting to see how he can do against a guy with the offensive moves that Falco has. You know, he's a guy who, to me, you know, it was in the UFC, was doing well, had a problem, got cut, had a heart attack, if I believe. You know, I read everything. He had medical issues nonetheless. He's making his way up this ladder. It'll be interesting to see how he bounces back from those medical woes. I'm not super thrilled with the middleweight tournament semifinal, but it'll be interesting, as we discussed earlier, to see how these guys are going to progress in case one of them gets an opportunity to fight Alexander Shulmenko for that title. We need to be following these guys, learning as much as we can about them as fight fans, and really gearing up, because if we have an all-Russian middleweight title fight between Vasilevsky,
read my mind.
Vasilevsky and Shulmenko,
Sean Wheelock's tongue might fall out from trying to pronounce these names.
Not only that, it's just going to be very fun. I think there's going to be a lot of people who may not normally tune in. You're going to get a different kind of an audience. You may have a lot of people who aren't interested at all. But for someone like me, I think for you, that's just a dynamic, interesting fight between guys that I don't know that, you know, casual fans have really paid enough attention to. And Vasilevsky, as I mentioned, I think he's the wild card in this whole thing. You just don't know enough about him to know if he's of the caliber of Brian Rogers or Shulmenko. Wouldn't put it past him if he was, though.
The following night, we finally have the UFC's return to pay-per-view, their bread and butter. UFC 145, you're going to have John Jones and Rashad Evans finally hooking up for that light heavyweight title. Greg Jackson is going to be in the corner of John Jones. I don't know how much that's going to really affect Rashad Evans at this point. I think that whole beef has been completely overblown at this stage. Had they been able to jump on that a little sooner, then sure. But then John Jones got hurt, and then Rashad Evans had his issues. So really, at this point, it's just a fight between two guys. And I think everybody's obviously giving John Jones the huge advantage. How does Rashad Evans come out of this with an upset win?
I think Rashad Evans that showed up against Phil Davis is a Rashad Evans that John Jones needs to be very, very careful about in this fight. There's this kind of underlying theme here that because John Jones has the entire Jackson camp behind him for this fight, that there's a confidence about him. He's comfortable. He knows enough about Rashad Evans that this fight should probably just go status quo. And I'm uncomfortable with that situation for the very fact that Rashad Evans now has a chip on his shoulder. It's him against the world. And in a situation like that where he's going to go out there and look to play mind games with John Jones, John Jones has never been beaten, you know, aside from the Matt Hamill debacle. He's never been beaten competitively inside a cage. I think the closest you and I have ever seen him come was Stephen Bonner.
And Machida also kind of rocked him in their fight as well.
Yeah, I guess in some context, maybe, but he also worked Machida with a standing guillotine and dropped him on his head. You know, John Jones has never really been tested, and Rashad Evans has every means to go in there with all the vitriol he can possibly muster against a guy he doesn't like anymore. I mean, these guys have a history, and I think people are taking that too lightly. I mean, Rashad Evans that showed up against Phil Davis was impressive to me. He negated a wrestler's wrestling. He was the better wrestler in that fight. And while he didn't really get to show off his offensive weapons, you know, his timely kicks, his good strikes, he shut down Phil Davis in a way that makes me think he can pose problems in the clinch and with his wrestling to John Jones. The thing about this fight that's intriguing to me, can John Jones clip Rashad Evans the same way that Machida did? Because that's the only loss on Rashad Evans' resume. You know, I mean, we're talking about a guy that He made the face that we see all over the internet that's on the GIFs and all sorts of stuff, and it's kind of become cannon fodder at this point. Because
he's a good fighter either way. He's a great, you could say he's a great fighter.
Probably the second best fighter on the planet. Here's my kind of my idea of this fight. It could easily play out like Rashad Rampage. I could easily see a grinding, boring fight where these fighters are just kind of wrapping each other up against the cage. Neither is mounting offense because both fighters are being defensive. They're being like-minded. They know each other very well. And I think that's a fight Rashad Evans can actually win. I mean, I think he's got the speed. I think he's got the wrestling. I think he can get some timely takedowns over five rounds to take John Jones to the ground. I think John Jones wins this fight by going out there in the first two or three rounds and just shutting up Rashad Evans, clipping him, knocking him out, and just kind of slamming the book shut and saying, next.
Does either one of them become gun-shy if they get clipped early? Say Rashad Evans hits John Jones with a flush shot. Either, you know, even if it's just a body shot, does that kind of make John Jones gun-shy at that point of kind of stepping into some of his punches?
I don't know if John Jones is the kind of guy with his confidence and his cockiness. I don't know if he ever will become gun-shy, and that may end up being his downfall. You know, I think you talk about who's going to beat John Jones, and that's kind of the prevailing theme out there. Who can step up and beat John Jones? And we talk about it on the show. Not a whole lot of challengers out there, aside from Rashad Evans and Dan Henderson. And I don't give Dan Henderson a real good chance to land his right hand because it's all he has at this point against a guy like John Jones. Aside from those two fighters, there's not a whole lot left in the division. So John Jones is looking at becoming potentially one of the greatest, if not the greatest, light heavyweight fighter of all time before he even decides to make a move to heavyweight. Rashad Evans is going to be the toughest test of his career because Rashad Evans just doesn't plain like him. And he's one of the best fighters in the world. I'm excited. I don't want to make a prediction right now because...
You have to. This is the last show before.
Okay, if I have to make a prediction, I'll go John Jones flash knockout in the first three rounds. However, the caveat to that is I honestly firmly believe if Rashad Evans can keep his chin on his head and drag this fight the distance, he's got a great shot of getting the decision. I know there's the whole trope that you have to take the title from the titleist. In this case, I think Rashad Evans has enough offensive weapons to win on points. And the longer the fight goes, the better I'm giving Rashad Evans odds to pull off an upset. But I'm not going to predict the upset. Let's put it that way.
Looking elsewhere down that card, we have Rory McDonald's and Shea Mills. Ben Rothwell and Brendan Schaub in a heavyweight fight. That's actually going to be a good one. I want to see how Brendan Schaub bounces back after the way that he was just crushed by Big Nog down in Brazil.
I'm interested in the fight because it marks the end of legitimacy for either of these guys. There was a point in time in the heavyweight stratosphere of mixed martial arts that Ben Rothwell was thought of as a guy who could be a top 10, potentially top 5 if everything fell perfectly. Fighter. Now he's 31-8, just coming off a debilitating loss to Mark Hunt. He's a guy who, you know, this is his last chance. He has to either prove that he's worthy of all the hype that he was given during his days outside the UFC when he was fighting under the Pat Miličić team. The IFL days, as they were. And Brendan Schaub is a guy who I think coming off tough 10, there was a lot of hype around him, and I don't know if he was ever as good as people thought. But he's 8-2, and a loss for him would also push him really far down the ladder. So it is an interesting fight because I think the winner of it remains relevant and hovers around the mix. And I think the loser is really close to being cut, if not dropped to the bottom of the totem pole.
Would you say that the winner of this fight might actually get someone like Matt Mitrione, who hasn't been heard from in a while but was still looking really impressive in his short body of work? I know he and Schaub were on the Ultimate Fighter season together.
I know the UFC doesn't really like doing this, but I would put the winner of this fight up against Chet Kongo. I think that Chet Kongo marks the very end of legitimate contenders in the UFC. He's proven with his loss to Hunt that he's not going to be a guy that's going to compete with top 10 fighters. And I made the mistake of being a Chet Kongo supporter and thinking Chet Kongo had the tools that he could go in there and kickbox and compete with Junior Dos Santos and those guys. He just doesn't. And it was a mistake on my part. And you know, begrudgingly, Chet Congo's a good fighter. He boasts one of the best heavyweight resumes in the UFC's history. But he's not a guy who's going to be competing for that title. I think he's an appropriate step up for Rothwell or Schaub should they win this fight. And you know, that's one of the more intriguing fights on the card, which to me speaks to the volume of kind of meh on the card. You know, Miguel Torres, Michael McDonald should be a fun fight. Chad Griggs is one of those guys coming over from Strikeforce, beat Bobby Lashley, I believe, and kind of derailed the Bobby Lashley hype train, put together some wins in Strikeforce, and is now fighting Travis Brown, speaking of a guy who fought Chet Congo. That's an interesting fight. John McDessie against Anthony Njokuani is going to be a great fight. I think there's going to be a lot of punches and kicks thrown that are going to make people wince in that fight. Those are two high-level kickboxers there. And
how about your very first fight of the night, Maximo Blanco and Marcus Brimage? I know we've both watched Maximo Blanco in other organizations and have been waiting for him to arrive in the UFC. Is this kind of their way of saying, well, let's see what you've got and putting him at the bottom of the card?
Well, I think if people don't remember, they should be reminded that he was fighting at, I believe, lightweight against Pat Healy in Strikeforce and was just absolutely mauled by Healy, who's a big lightweight guy who probably could compete at welterweight. Maxi Blanco, a guy you and I have seen for years in Sengoku, he's a violent, violent dude. If I were a betting man and I were looking for lines on this fight, if he's not getting 5-1 odds as a favorite, you know, there's something wrong.
Wasn't Marcus Brimage on this last season of The Ultimate Fighter with
one
Mayhem
of the last couple seasons? Yeah, I mean he's a power puncher. I don't know that he's a bad fighter, but you know, if we're going to talk class of strikers here, I think Maxi Blanco's on a different planet. Maxi Blanco's one of those guys, if he's not facing a big grappler or a big wrestler, he's going to maul the heck out of dudes. And everyone who watches, you know, this fight's going to be a prelim fight on Facebook. It's going to be a dynamite fight. First fight on the card, as you mentioned, you get to go out there. I fully expect, book it right now. I'm saying it. If you're gambling, or if you're just keeping track at home, Maxi Blanco is going to knock out, I'm not even talking TKO, he's going to knock out Marcus Brimage. I mean, that is one of the biggest mismatches I've seen in the UFC in a long time. And I don't mean that to be completely disrespectful to Marcus Brimage. He's obviously earned himself, you know, himself a UFC fights, but he's on a completely different level than Maxi Blanco. That should be a fun fight. I don't see a whole lot else on that card that excites me. What excites you?
Well, I'm actually excited to see where Maxi Blanco winds up in the range between Lyman Good and C.R. Bahadurzada. I said it fine earlier.
Bahadurzada.
see where he winds up in the knockout, in the first round knockout stage. You go 13 to 42 seconds. I think he could do that with Marcus Brimage. I'm interested to see where Mark Hominick comes back. Because the last time we saw him, he had that ridiculous hematoma on his head from Jose Aldo, and he's a guy that could use a win to get his confidence back. I feel like, you know, there's really not a whole lot else. I mean, we both know the Anthony Njokuani story with the WEC. Mac Danzig and Efrain Escudero being that far down on a card, I think, is kind of silly. Not a whole lot really to look at, but a lot of opportunity for a lot of guys to go look at us. We're the reason that you're watching the UFC. We're the next wave of guys coming. It's underwhelming on paper, but sometimes the underwhelming ones are going to be the best fights.
Well, when you speak to the youth and all that, as far as look at me, I'm the new wave of fighter, you're automatically talking about a guy like Rory McDonald or Michael McDonald. I don't believe that they're related. The spellings are different, and I believe that
one of them's a Canadian singer. I hope they're not.
Well, that's good info for fight fans right there. Rory is the guy at 12-1. He's facing Chae Mills, who's 14-4 in the co-main event. I think that's an intriguing fight for both fighters. Chae Mills kind of burst on the scene. He's the kind of guy at 29 from England. Defeated Chris Cope at UFC 138 and looked absolutely dynamite. I don't know where he stands in the pecking order at 170, but we're going to find out against Rory McDonald, who's a very, very solid fighter. A guy I enjoy watching him fight, because German suplex of Nate Diaz at UFC 129 will forever live on in my memory. He did it three times, Chris Benoit style. He's coming off two wins you know, Nate Diaz and Mike Pyle, who are very good fighters in the welterweight division. His last loss, I guess you could say the only loss of his career, Carlos Condit, who I believe holds something of importance in the UFC.
No, he shouldn't have won that fight. Nick Diaz won.
Oh, that's right. He holds the interim Diaz title. Won. So, you know, Rory McDonald's a star in the making. You mentioned Mark Hominick earlier. His opponent's Eddie Yagan. Eddie's an interesting guy because, you know, he's been on the California circuit for a long time, and he got his UFC opportunity by derailing Joe Soto at Tachi Palace 10 by a guillotine choke. And Joe Soto, for people who, you know, are a fan of the show, a fan of mixed martial arts, is the 25-year-old former Bellator champion in the, I believe it was featherweight division, might have been lightweight division now that I'm thinking about it, but he had a horrible loss to Joe Warren, and that became the beginning of the title reign for Joe Warren. But since then, Joe Soto's kind of dropped off a little bit. He's 1-2 in his last three fights, and Eddie Yagan moved up the ladder with a win over him. So you talk about guys who have made names for themselves, stepped up, you know, won the right fights and taken opportunities in the UFC. You know, his only fight in the UFC is against Junior Sun Sao. He lost that fight. So this is probably the end of the road for Eddie Yagan, and I think that makes him a dangerous opponent. He's very well-rounded. 15 wins, 5 by TKO or KO, 5 by submission, and 5 by decision. So he's a guy who can look to win a fight anywhere. I'm excited to see how Mark Hominick bounces back, and he's got a very interesting opponent. But looking at this card, aside from some heavyweight action, the main event, and there are a couple up and comers as we mentioned, you know, it doesn't look super great on paper. I expect the Bellator card, top to bottom, to stack up and have the better fights.
All right, and that's our show for this week. I'm Kevin Mendelson. That's Marcus Schmidley. Marcus, anything big coming up on the writing side for you?
Well, I've got a High Fives edition of UFC in Sweden and Bellator 65 coverage. It'll probably get out in the next couple of days. Should be doing some fighter interviews as well. And on the show in the next couple of weeks, I hope to have a potential UFC fighter. He's a young kid. He'll be facing Din Thomas in May. We'll get him on the show. We're not going to give away names just yet because nothing is official, but we'll break some news maybe next week on the edition of the MMA Cutman.
Enjoy the fights, everybody. Hit us up on Facebook, facebook.com/the MMA Cutman. Thanks for listening. I'm Kevin Mendelson. That's Marcus Schmidley. We'll talk to you next week.
It's all over! We'll be right back.